We should get started. Good morning. I'm Nico Kriegesknot. I'm going to be chairing the session. The first talk is by Francisco Pereira, formerly Carnegie Mellon, now at Princeton. And his title is going to be Introduction to Machine Learning for fMRI Data.
Can you hear me clearly? Yeah? No. I always forget, it's a stupid question to ask. Rest assured, I'm an expert otherwise. Okay, so before we get started, I usually put little pictures to remind me of things to say that I should really stress. And in this case, the thing to say is by the end of this, you'll get the sense that I see classifiers as a hammer, so every problem looks like a nail. The point of this is to say that it's a really powerful hammer, and you'll be like gods once you have its power. So, before I even get started, I would also like to stress that the slides will be up, so you don't have to worry too much about taking notes if something is useful. Perhaps more important, we have a companion tutorial paper to go with this talk, where most of the points are discussed in a lot more detail. This is in part so that I can refer people to something, but also so that I can just focus on what's more interesting rather than spend half the time telling you don't do this, don't do that, which makes for a really boring talk. This figure is just so that you can remind you that, unlike maybe in the other talks, this is tutorial, so you should really feel free to ask any clarification questions and occasionally express some violent dissent. You should also feel free to do that afterwards and send me an email if you have any questions at any point. I'm more than happy to answer them. So without further ado, I could start if people have been using the words machine learning throughout the entire workshop, and I'm not sure if anyone put up a definition. And the textbook one is the study of how to build computer systems that improve with experience. And this, like all these textbook definitions, sounds a bit vague, mostly because it has to cover a lot of stuff. So the practical definitions are, on one side, that it's a kind of applied, very, very applied version of a lot of statistical techniques, where we also are very, we are not necessarily very principled, and this is the obligatory George Box quote, because it's true. Most of the models I'm going to talk about today might not have much to do with how the information is organized, is actually organized in the brain, but they are good enough to extract conclusions from it and to test hypotheses. So I had that quote there before all the other talks had the quote there, and that's all I'm going to say. So today's subset of machine learning methods that I'll talk about is mostly classifiers. So it's just the proverbial black box that will take part of the brain or of other things and predict something. Namely, say, what is this subject seeing at the time this image was acquired? And put that in contrast with a normal technique. So, in GLM, you'd have some contrast of interest, and you're finding voxels one by one that reflect it. That's probably the main way of contrasting the two things, although I use both of them, so I don't have any particular need to use classifiers if GLMs will do. And the rest is of the talk. So part of the talk is trying to make you help you understand what's in this black box and what kinds of questions you can ask with it, and then how to use it to find information in the data and also to test hypotheses. In order to make the talk more concrete, I usually like to start with one example which I can refer to over and over. In this case, it's a study from Marshall Jess' group at CMU, where the subjects were reading concrete nouns. So you see the names of tools or names of buildings. They will see the word for 3 seconds, they will think about its properties or about using the tool or visualizing the building or such things. And then for about 8 seconds, they would just try to clear their mind from it. Not necessarily the best design, but it's the data that we had to work with. And their goal was, they were wondering if these are word stimuli, can the two categories still be distinguished? And what we did in this case was, for every trial, we average the images around the trial peak, and we essentially get one image and a label, which is just the category of the thing that the subject was seeing. Is this clear? Good. So I'm going to use this to introduce the terminology that's standard and that you'll see in machine learning papers if you start looking at them. So we start with, I told you how we got this average image for every trial. We usually take this and string all the voxel values into a long, long, long vector, which we call an example. The voxels, or the things that make up this example, are called features, and every such example has an associated label, in this case tools, what the subject was seeing. In this study, we have 7 different items for every of the 2 categories, so a total of 14 examples, and I'm calling that a group. And then a data set is made out of 6 groups where the examples are all shown before you move on to the next group and show all the examples again. So in this case, the easiest way of using this for classification is to divide that data set in 2 halves. So in this case, even epochs and odd epochs, and use one part of it as training data, so the thing we're going to learn a classifier from, and the other one to test the classifier in. So in this case, we take this plus the labels, we somehow learn a classifier, we then use that classifier on the test data to predict some labels. And because we have the labels for the entire data set, we can now look at these and compare them with the predictions, and maybe we did well or maybe we didn't do well. In this case, with this division, it's around 65%. And note that I'm not going to say above chance, below chance. This is just a point estimate, and to give you an idea of what the typical workflow in using classifiers is. You need a training data, you need a test data. This is not normally how things are done in your image, except if you're Steve Strother or Lars Hansen. But so is this clear? Okay. So to just recap, classifier, you can view it as a function from the data to the labels, and you learn the parameters from the training data. And essentially what you want to do here is estimate the true accuracy of a classifier. So this is the probability of, should I build this classifier for my training data, a new example comes along, I need to make a prediction, what's the probability that I'm going to be correct? I mean, if you have conquered absolutely everything in the data, it should be 1. In general, it is not 1, and the interest is in how high it is. And we cannot really figure this out, but we can estimate it on the test data. So this was the point of having examples where you've not seen the labels and the classifier hasn't seen before, so that you can try and estimate this true accuracy. But this is a point that Tom Nichols makes often to people going on and on about classifiers. This is just a point estimate, and your test set is finite. So this is an estimate with some uncertainty around it. And later on the talk, I'm going to go over how we can quantify that uncertainty as a function of how big your test set is. Does all of this make sense? Good. And the kind of null hypothesis that we're going to be testing is that the classifier learned nothing at all. So this is the closest this talk ever gets to an outline slide. And I should say that this is kind of my perspective and not necessarily established terminology in the field. But from my viewpoint, the classifiers can be used to answer 3 broad classes of questions. So the first one is whether there's information on about a variable of interest on whatever you feed the classifier. So it should be just, I call this discrimination. Beyond that, you can use them to say whether that information is present in a certain place at a certain time or in voxels selected in a particular way. So if you're trying to use this kind of just to test different views of the data to say, is the information here about something? Is there information there about something else? And finally, this is the most important one, is we really care about how the activation represents whatever the subject is doing. And it is also possible to use classifiers to get at this, although it's much more subtle and intricate. So most of the talk will be spent on doing this and trying to also set up all the other talks, and then I'll spend some more time on doing the other 2 things. But broadly, do these questions make sense? Good. So as far as testing whether there's information there, I'm going to tell you what's inside that black box and how to also test these results. And then in transition to the next session, I'm going to show you the many ways in which you could go from a study to example. So I've showed you one, which was to take a trial and average one image at the peak. but there's many, many other things you could do other than just using the voxels as features and generating one example per trial. So the simplest I usually bring this up first because the simplest function you could learn from the test, from the training data to the labels, is actually no function at all. Something we call nearest neighbor. And to make this, I think, easier to explain, I've made a pseudo brain with two voxels. And so now every image has only two voxels, and this training data has got three images of tools and three images of buildings. And suppose that now a new example comes along and you have to, and you want to classify it. Does anyone want to care to guess what label the example is going to get? Come on, there's a big
loop.
Yeah. So I call it nearest neighbor for a reason, and it's kind of intuitive to us to say it's going to look more similar to a tool. And it is. And so in this case, all that's required is some notion of which examples are similar to each other examples. And often this, sometimes people do this concentrating just on computing similarity of patterns over one part of the brain. So it's more subtle than it might appear, but there are at least two science papers that I know of that just use nearest neighbor and one Nature paper. So don't dismiss this because it's very simple. And if you have very few examples, it's often the best thing to try. So the next simplest function is to learn a linear discriminant that separates these and have some kind of rule that says if you fall to this side, you are a tool. If you fall to this side, you are a building, based on your value of voxel 2 and of voxel 1. Now, you probably are thinking, you just put one line there, and you could put many other lines. And it's absolutely true. In fact, there's an infinity of lines that are going to do this separation. And in general, because you have many more voxels than you have examples, there is an infinity of lines that all separate it really, really well. So in this case, if you had the example there, you'd still call it a tool. So to make that idea of having the line and being on one side and the other side more formal, doing that, deciding to classify examples that way is mathematically equivalent to doing this. So taking the example, all the voxel values, so this is a test example, and multiplying them by weights, one weight per voxel. And if the total comes out positive, it will be on one side of the line, you assign tools. If it comes out negative, it's on the other side, you assign buildings. So the various kinds of classifiers that you might have heard about, namely these three, they differ on how these weights are assigned. So even when people are using linear classifiers and trying to interpret what these weights are, I'm generally a bit wary and ask them, have you tried the three different classifiers? Because the weights will be different, and there's different assumptions that the classifiers are making, and reasons why one of them might work where the others don't. So even knowing it's linear doesn't necessarily tell you all that you need to know. And the tutorial has a bit more on this. And in case you're wondering what these weights look like for, say, an SVM, they look like this. It's kind of noisy, but the positive weights here are around the central sulcus, and so they are positive, so they pull this towards being greater than zero, and you predict tools. Down here, they are strongly negative. The Prehable-Campbell gyrus is somewhere around there. I know the structures for this data set, and the weights pull towards negative, hence towards buildings. Does this make sense? Because I'm going to use these later on the talk, and I wanted to make sure that this was kind of clear in your heads. Okay.
What are the different images, different slices?
Sorry, yes, there are different slices in this case. I kind of cropped the Z's out accidentally. Thank you. Yeah, so at this point people usually ask me, but haven't people come out with all these fancy classifiers that can learn many more complicated things than just weighted combinations of the features? And yes. And unfortunately, in this domain, there are reasons they don't work. I'll get into that. Or you need some care to make them work. But the thing that I wanted to point out is something that's pointed out less often, which is that even these classifiers are linear, not on the original space, but on a transformed feature space. So to make this more concrete, let's say again you have two voxels. If you're training a neural network to make this distinction and you have a hidden layer, you are essentially learning new features, so the hidden layer, that then get combined to produce a decision. But if you look at this part, this can be viewed as a linear classifier. So, and if you're doing an SVM, it's even nicer because the features are not learned. They are implicitly determined by your choice of kernel. And to make this more concrete, quadratic SVM, you'd take the original voxels and have them as features, but also have their interaction. So think of quadratic SVM a bit like a linear regression with interactions. It's a gross simplification, but that's more or less how it works. And then you'd learn a linear classifier that looks at the voxels, but also at their interaction. So does this make sense? Yeah, and different and other kernels are doing, going to do more interesting things. But again, it's important that you know whether this, the kinds of things it's computing, like voxel interactions, like these are important for what you want to find in the data or not. So the reasons to be careful, this is to remind me that sometimes it's good to be constrained, is that generally we have too few examples and too many features. So a lot of the linear classifier, the nonlinear classifiers will not be able to find something that they can, or they can be tripped way too easily by noise on features. And they're also a bit harder to interpret. But the term that I wanted to bring up here is overfitting. And this is the idea that as you can arbitrarily increase the complexity of your model, say train a nonlinear classifier of some sort on the data, and get perfect accuracy on the training set. You can do it even with a linear classifier. But that doesn't mean that you are learning a classifier that will generalize well to the new examples. And so this is what this curve gives you, is your prediction error goes down and down as you increase model complexity, but if you look at here in the test set, eventually it goes up. So essentially you want to find the sweet spot where the model is as complex as you can make it to model lots of interesting things that, that you care about, but not too complicated. Does this make sense? So just to refresh your minds, we had this workflow with training data, learn classifier, apply test set, and produce these labels. And I'm going to zoom in on this part of the diagram now, so to see how we can test them. So you have your predicted labels, you have the labels that you left out, so now you can compare them, and you see that a certain number of errors were made. So what you'd like to find out is, you essentially want to prove that you want to reject the null hypothesis that the classifier learned nothing. And learning nothing in this sense means that all these predictions were made essentially at random. And that's key. So under the null hypothesis, you assume that the classifier is deciding a chance. And so the intuition is that you declare a result significant if it's really unlikely under the null hypothesis. Again, nothing new, just want to put this in the classifier setting. So if I call x to be let's say x is the correct number of the number of examples labeled correctly, the test examples, the probability of x under the null is just a binomial with the number of test examples that you have, and so the p-value is going to be the probability that x exceeds the result that you got with your classifier, given under this null hypothesis. And just remind you of what it looks like. If your test set has 10 examples, this is how wide the binomial distribution gets. So you'd need a result pretty much far out on the tail to be able to say significant, and even then you might not be able to with a very low p-value. My data sets typically are on this region, so you still have to get pretty high. And once you get here, it's nice, but people often don't have 100 examples. So essentially, what you have to keep in mind is that this accuracy is an estimate. How good an estimate depends on how large your test set is, so there's uncertainty. You can get confidence intervals for this, and there's a pointer in the tutorial. And you absolutely also should take into account the fact that you need to correct for multiple comparisons. So often people are trying several different classifiers, or selecting various numbers of features, or using different methods for selecting them. And so you are doing many of these tests. And I have this here just to remind you that up till now, I think reviewers haven't been entirely strict with hunting people on for this kind of thing. But people are catching on to it and sort of getting tired of just seeing spurious accuracy numbers without any uncertainty or anything else. So things are going to get stricter, and so that reviewers don't punish you, remember this. And the tutorial tells you more about how to correct in typical situations where multiple comparisons appear. The final thing I wanted to mention in terms of mechanics of classifier is that typically we are not just doing this split into one half of the data for training and one half for testing, because that's fairly wasteful. Essentially, it means that you are learning an example just from half of the data, so you might not learning as good a model as you want to, and you're testing on half. So I've just shown you that having a small test set makes your estimate more uncertain. So what's typically done is something called cross-validation, so we started out with six groups. So you typically say five groups go for training, one is for testing. We learn one classifier from this group, apply it here, get labels for these examples, and you divide the others similarly all the way through the six, leaving out each of these six as a test set. So I won't get into too much detail about the implications of this, just that if you see it in papers, that's why it's being done. So it's an attempt to have almost all of your cake and eat it too, in the sense that you get to use every single example as test at some point, and you pretty much use almost all of it for training. So the summary of all of this is that you should hopefully have a clear idea of the different types of classifiers that there are, and also of the common workflow for deploying those classifiers on a data set, and how to test the results. But this would be a good point to ask if you have any questions or... Yeah?
Are there any results on when the cross-validation, leaving one out, is kosher or not?
It's kosher as long as you don't have contamination between this and this. So in this case, I'm leaving out example groups because they are separated in time. So I can roughly say I'm not... The examples here are not correlated with the examples here. So that would be the kind of the general guideline. So people often do things like leaving one run out and training on the remaining runs, and that's generally kosher. So what's not kosher is to do things like you make your individual time points be examples, and you take some of them as test and some of them as train, because essentially your training set will contain images that are very similar to those in the test set because they came from adjacent time points. So that kind of thing is what you need to watch out for. Janine?
Yes, you make sure using the binomial distribution to keep a p-value for the classifier. What about using a non-parametric approach when you remove the labels and you create a classifier any part and then you can estimate the p-value?
Yeah, so what Janine is saying is that instead of doing that p-value, obtaining that p-value analytically by saying the distribution is a binomial, I could have done it differently by saying under my null hypothesis that the classifier is learning nothing or that there's no information there, I could permute the labels on my training set. And then essentially I'm assuming that I'm destroying the information, and so the classifier won't be able to learn anything. And you get the null that way. So you permute one way, train the classifier, get a result. Permute another way, train the classifier, get a result. You can do that. It's more, in general, that's what I prefer to do, but I didn't want to get into too much detail here. It's nicer in the sense that if you have some complicated procedure, like you get, you're testing various things, get different results which are correlated between each other, you pick the maximum out of those to report, then doing a permutation test is actually the only way to solve this. And we have an appendix on the tutorial paper that covers the use of permutation tests for dealing with this. But thank you for bringing that up. It's important. Any more questions before I move on? Yeah?
So you had in your example that the two words had equal probability, right?
Yeah.
If they didn't, doesn't that sort of mess this up?
Yes, it completely messes this up, and then you have to look at it a bit differently. So you could either undersample the one that's most numerous, or rather, you can train it using an equal number of examples, and some classifiers can deal with that just fine. The important thing is that you then go look at individual predictions and see whether, let's say that you have 10% of one class and 90% of the other. You should definitely go and look at, if you get an accuracy of 90%, for all you know, it could just be defaulting to predicting the most frequent one. And so what you should do there first is you can train with everything, then go look at the predictions and see whether it makes many more errors in the least numerous class than in the other one. if it does, you might want to balance it out somehow. So one way is to just sample a part of the most numerous class. But, and there's other ways of dealing with that, but that's a very good point. But maybe more than I want to get into.
Okay.
The tutorial mentions that and a couple of strategies for dealing with it. Any other questions? Okay. So that kind of wraps up the first question. So now for the really interesting ones, where I don't have to feel as tutorial and as responsible and conservative about any advice that I give you, and I can go out on a limb. So in order to talk about this, I'd like to introduce another case study that will be helpful both now and later. Some of you may know this paper. This was done by Camitani and Tom in 2005, and it's a study where subjects see gratings in one of eight orientations. And if you actually go and look at voxels in visual cortex, so these are the eight orientations for two different voxels, and you look at how they respond, these are just the values of the voxel and these are the error bars. The voxels don't really have any strong response to any of the orientations. This makes sense because columns are responsible to orientations, not voxels, and voxels are going to have a fair number of columns inside them. But the thing that's interesting is that they can, if they put all of these voxels together into linear SVM, you can somehow combine them to produce a much more precise response that says it's this orientation, a little bit less confident for the ones that are similar to it, and then drops sharply for the others. So this is kind of interesting in part because it says that there might be information that's so diffuse that you just need to pull it using those different weights, and I'm going to talk about that later. For now, I wanted this kind of as an illustration that in the first case study, we are using features. So voxels were our features. In this study, they are still voxels, but they are voxels from visual cortex. So they're now making a statement about not just saying that there's information somewhere in the brain, but now that there's information in one specific part. So you can see where this leads. It's, again, another neophrenology in a way. So you could ask me, what else could these things be? And another study which we have a chance to analyze were when where subjects were reading ambiguous or unambiguous sentences. And so the difference in activation was not which voxels were involved in the task. It was the same in both, roughly. But it was what happened through time in a lot of these voxels was that in one condition they would stay on, in another one you'd have this nice bimodal response. So in this case, the way to learn this was to actually train a classifier where we wouldn't just use, say, one image per trial. We would use all the images in a trial. And Janine is going to talk more about doing these kind of spatial-temporal classifiers. I just wanted to bring it up to help you put her talk in perspective in the whole grand scheme of things. So keeping those in mind, the first key idea in doing localization classifiers is that essentially the conclusions you test about whether there's information or not pertain to whatever you're feeding the classifier. And the other thing is that you're not really limited to the stimuli you are showing the subject. You could be saying, is this subject actually perceiving something rather than what I'm showing him or her? Is the subject behaving in this way? Is the subject feeling something? How is the subject going to respond? So you can kind of do this in two directions. You can say, I want to see if this place has information about this or that or that. And you should keep all of this in mind because as far as the classifier is concerned, it's all the same. And so in addition to using location and time, which are kind of the most obvious things, the other criteria that are used to kind of narrow the focus of what's fed to the classifier are essentially things that hinge on the voxel's behavior or how they relate to the label. And I'm going to make this concrete. The technical name for this is feature selection, which is what Isabel's talk is going to be about. And it goes more or less like this. So you look at your training data and the labels, and I put this in red to remind me that people often select voxels looking at their entire data set using the labels of the test set, and surprise, this actually biases your accuracy estimates positively a lot. But you'd be surprised at how many high-profile papers do something like this or close to this. give you an idea of what the criteria could be, so it could be, for instance, this. All of these graphs have just a voxel's mean activity level in one condition, another one, another one. So a typical one is to say the voxel is much more active during either of your task conditions relative to a baseline, which kind of makes sense. So the voxel is doing something. Another one will be one where you say, well, I don't just care that the voxel does something in all the conditions versus baseline. I want it to be doing different things across some of the conditions. So think of an ANOVA where you're testing the means of what the voxel does across conditions to be different. Another one, that's something that appears in Haxby's 2001 paper in Science, and also in Nancy Kanwisha's response to that, is the notion that you don't just want voxels to do them something different in one condition versus another. You want one of them to be so high that it dwarfs the others. So this is saying you have a preferential response to condition B, not just you respond to condition B in this graph. Another one that I've also seen people use with success was some measure of stability, which is you don't really care about what a voxel does across conditions, but you want whatever it does to be consistent across runs if you line up the things. So it might be a voxel that's doing nothing, but at least it's consistent, so it doesn't just flip out with a lot of noise. Or it might be a voxel that's actually reliably ticking for the different conditions, and you can kind of trust it. So essentially, this is a measure of trustworthiness of the voxel. Do these all make sense? They should be pretty common sense. There's many other criteria that are less domain-specific than these, but I like these because they reflect behaviors that people expect to find in voxels. So to go back to our workflow with training data, test data, and everything else, this means that we're going to look at all the voxels and judge them by how well they fit one of those criteria, for whatever of those criteria we picked. And so let's say that in this case we find three voxels that we really, really like. And we're going to use those, and just those, to feed to the classifier. So essentially you are forgetting about everything else in the training and test data, and essentially building a classifier just in terms of these three voxels, and then using that to do whatever else we just did before. Does this make sense? Good. So this is often fantastic for improving your prediction accuracy. And if all you care about is possibly diagnosis, diagnosis you care a bit more about whether the results are trustworthy and make sense in other ways. But if you just want to do lie detection, say, and nothing else, then this probably would be great. You find all these spots that reliably help you doing this prediction, you don't care where they're coming from in the brain as long as they tell you what you want to know. But what this means is that often, just because of the way the criteria work, the voxels come from all over the place. So it's kind of hard to interpret exactly what the classifier is using to produce information, or whether those are the only voxels that have the information. So this kind of gives you a subset of voxels that do stuff, but it doesn't tell you it's all the voxels that do what you're interested in. And if you're doing something like cross-validation that I was showing you earlier, often between different cross-validation folds, you'll get entirely different voxel sets. So this is not very nice if you want to report it, or because people have a lot of trouble making sense of this if they expect to see blobs or consistent locations. There's ways around this, but this is generally the problem that people run into. So before I get into that, the tutorial has some tips on how you might alleviate this, but it's generally so if people ask me, what can't you just improve things by selecting features, this is usually the price you have to pay for doing that. So there's other ways of doing it, like using one of the matrix decomposition methods that were described earlier this week, which give you loadings across all the voxels. Essentially, you learn this low-dimensional representation of the data, train a classifier on it, and then the classifier weights can be, again, redistributed over the entire image. So that's a bit nicer, but it has other problems of its own. The other thing that I wanted to cover when you're talking about localization is an interesting case study that Ken Norman will probably mention in his talk. This is work from his lab, which is, what we care about is not really space. What we want to know is whether you're doing some task which requires encoding lists to memory, or stuff to memory, and you want to know whether at the time that you are recalling, you get essentially the same activation patterns that you got when you were encoding the information. So in this study, what they did was they trained on encoding blocks, so pretty clean data, and deployed it on event-related recall data. And what you see here is this curve is just an estimate of the classifier learned from the encoding blocks of how much a pattern of one of the three classes is present. And this is the thing that was actually the class that was recalled when it was recalled. So essentially, you can use the classifier as a sensor for how strongly a pattern is getting reinstated, and so it ebbs and flows over time. And this is kind of a very creative use of the classifiers that departs from just using space. So you can also use them to detect things on the time domain. There are many other examples, but I think those kind of cover the spectrum of the basic things you can do in terms of localization. The final, more interesting question is, how can you use the classifiers to get at how the information is encoded in the brain? And I call this characterization, and I'm not sure if it's necessarily the catchiest term. So this is really a matter of classifier dissection. So a classifier is a function that learns to relate the features to labels. So up till now, I've been kind of thinking of, okay, we make the whole argument about what information is by controlling what gets selected and then saying, well, I fed the classifier this, the classifier learned it, thus the classifier had, so whatever I fed the classifier has the information. But you can also ask it in reverse and saying, okay, but where did the classifier put weights? What did the classifier use from what I fed it? And in the linear classifiers, that's essentially looking at the voxel weights. So in this case, we go back to my first case study, so the tools versus buildings. These are two different classifiers, Gaussian naive Bayes and linear SVM. And these are the weights over all these slices of brain. And I usually put up this slide because there's two things to see there. So if you are an optimist, you'll see that there's a lot of overlap where the largest weights are. So he says, hooray, this thing can find consistent stuff in the brain. If, like me, you kind of are grumpy about these things and just see all the nasty, speckly stuff around the image, or you might see there's actually differences. And more importantly, there's actually a large difference in accuracy between these two. So there's a few differences you can see with the naked eye, but it's not very much. But those differences account for about 15% in accuracy. So even though these things are linear classifiers, the assumptions that they make really, really matter. So if you were going to, and typically people would train one of these. So they would say, here's my classifier, here's my weights, here's what matters. You could have trained another one, you'd get different weights, and maybe you could train another one and say the weights coincide in these places, and then I would trust those weights more. But this is more to say, yes, you can do this, and people often ask me, can you just put maps of weights? You can, but you have to know what the classifier likes to downweigh and what it likes to upweigh. And so this is less of an issue if you're using feature selection, then the weights tend to match more across classifiers, but I wanted to raise this point. You can also say, let's say we started with these weights, there's a lot of speckly stuff. You could just resample many, many training sets from your original training set and learn and look at the weights you learn. And you can kind of get, for every voxel, a distribution over resamplings of how much that weight varies. And this is a binary image that says that for a given criterion of whether a voxel seems to have a weight that's reliably different from zero. And you can use this to threshold this to give you another image. In this case, it's a fairly lax criterion, so a lot of the things still survive. But in practice, it's one way of dealing with it. Again, it has to do with realizing that when the classifier gets trained, you are estimating some parameters, in this case, the voxel weights. And those also have sampling distributions. So the bootstrap gets a bit at what that distribution is and how much you can perhaps trust or not trust the voxels. Does this make sense? Good. So given that all those nasty maps, there's, I usually point people to Nico's work, and he's going to talk about this later, where instead of training classifier on the entire brain and then trying to go down and through space and find interesting spots, you could just train classifiers on really small neighborhoods. So these are often called searchlights. It also has a more fancy name, the information-based mapping. But the key idea here is that because you're training on a small neighborhood, you get localization power, but you also have more examples than you have features, or you have a closer number. So now you can train models, for instance, using a covariance matrix between voxels that can capture some degree of interaction between them. Because up till now we've been doing linear classifiers, and one thing that's kind of noticeably absent is interactions between the voxels. So in those models which put one weight per voxel, the voxel only affects the decision through its weight, not through the value of the other voxels. This is a slight simplification, but that's more or less how it goes. But here you can learn something much more complicated in every one of these little neighborhoods where a classifier was trained, including nonlinear classifiers. The flip side is that if maybe you can distinguish eight classes over the entire brain, maybe you can distinguish eight classes in a small neighborhood, because there's just not enough things, different things being represented there. That's usually the trade-off. So this yields an accuracy map. So it's similar to the maps we've just been seeing, but now what I'm plotting in every voxel is the accuracy of the classifier based on it. The first one is actually a classifier that's on a single voxel. So it's learning to distinguish on every single voxel whether it's seeing a tool or a building. And so you can ask for every one of these 10,000 voxel classifiers, how accurate is it? And you can plot that accuracy. So the scale is 0 to 1. I forgot to put the scales, but green is around 50%. And the things that are in brown are significantly accurate. So you can test every one of these accuracies individually, and you can then mark it as significant or not. And as we go through different classifiers, so a voxel-wise naive Bayes, a searchlight naive Bayes, linear discriminant analysis, or linear SVM, all trained on little voxel neighborhoods, you can see that, again, reassuringly, the classifiers that use a neighborhood, these three, all put weights in similar places that match what we had seen earlier, so the parts of motor cortex. But the thing that's interesting, though, is that even then, the accuracies for the different classifiers are different. And if you're going to individually do significance tests for each one of these accuracy results on every voxel, and using false discovery rate to threshold everything, the number of voxels that survive threshold, which is this number per slice, that's on top of the slice, is different from classifier to classifier. So even here, it matters which local classifier and relationship between the voxels you are hypothesizing, but also how robust it is to error. So linear discriminant analysis is learning a full covariance matrix. In some parts of the brain, that's really going to buy you a lot. In other parts, maybe not. This is just a two-class problem, so maybe the extra complexity doesn't really buy you much. In multi-class problems, it might. But again, it's just an exhortation to say, don't settle for a single classifier, because there are differences. And there's also differences in how susceptible they are to, say, halving the amount of training data that you give them. In this case, that's what I did. So it's just the same maps as I had before, but now with half the training data. And a lot of so LDA in this case loses a lot of the accuracy throughout a lot of the brain, because it's estimating a covariance matrix with very few examples to begin with. Whereas SVM is much more robust, and naive Bayes is also pretty robust. So yeah?
Is the searchlight Gaussian naive Bayes essentially a local smoothing kernel?
Depends on the task. So for some of them, if you smooth the data, you get pretty much the same accuracy. So that's essentially what it's doing. In other tasks, it will actually the smoothing will actually destroy information, and naive Bayes will do better than just smoothing the data there.
Minimum Euclidean distance, right? Minimum Euclidean distance, or no smoothing, I think, right?
Well, we can talk about it afterwards.
Yeah, but this is also meant to trigger discussion, and clearly it will. But that's the main point, is to say, do not take your conclusions at face value, because the classifiers are sensitive to how many examples you have and to also to the kind of patterns that are present in the data. So you should often try to compare different things, and that will give you a much better picture, and sometimes even say half the amount of training data to see what survives. So in this case, a lot of the stuff that we found before that's really robust, it's still there when we use half the data. So, and that's kind of a good guideline. If something survives cutting off half the data, then it's probably there. If it doesn't, then you should maybe be careful.
Can you just clarify again, the numbers at the top are?
Oh, it just if so. Every voxel has an accuracy of the classifier based on its batch. That's an accuracy that you can get a p-value for using the method I described earlier. And then you have a map of p-values you can use false discovery rate and threshold that. So the number on top of each slice is how many voxels survive that thresholding.
So it seems that GNB does great here, and the other two, LEA and SVM, basically don't work. Right?
But it's a two-class problem. So essentially, there's not a lot of structure to be learned. That's kind of where I'm cheating here. I'm doing this a bit for dramatic effect. So in practice, if you have more classes or a more interesting local structure, I would expect LDA to do better because it can learn the covariance matrix. But in this case, this looks kind of dramatic, and it means that essentially it's not just what's there, it's how much data you have, and again, what assumptions you make. So I kind of gave you this tour through starting with the nearest neighbor correlation, then using linear classifiers with all the voxels, then we kind of select them, then we bring in some locality information in which voxels we consider, or you can also bring it in classifier. You could say, I want to learn a classifier with voxel-wise weights, but the weights can't be too unsmooth. You can use that to constrain the weight estimates, a bit like all the smooth estimates we've seen throughout the week. But there's kind of a structure to this list, which is that essentially, as the examples that I gave you brought in progressively more domain about information about the domain, such as maybe we expect neighboring voxels to carry similar sorts of information, maybe we expect certain behaviors to be more informative for the particular thing that we envisage the brain is doing in the task we're interested in. And the kind of extreme of this is if we actually know something about the computation the brain is doing, then you could build a model where you are kind of saying, I know what, given my stimulus, my image ought to be like. And you can kind of reverse that to get at what, from the image, at what your stimulus was, or what the brain was doing. I'm going to make this more concrete. This is a really, really nice study. It's published in Nature earlier this year, where essentially what they are doing is saying the subject sees images, and these images are going to be processed through visual cortex. Now, what do we know about visual cortex? Well, we have some decent models for what computations neuronal populations are doing in visual cortex. In this case, they use a Gabor filter pyramid. And given that, and assuming they're scanning at fairly high res, assuming a certain number of columns per voxel, and a pyramid of Gabor filters, you kind of have a model for what every voxel is doing. And so you feed it in, you have the fMRI data, and you fit this model for what this voxel ought to be doing, given the inputs and given what you see in the signal. And so you kind of tweak the model of this Gabor filter pyramid for that voxel so that you learn a good way of seeing this, predicting what this ought to be. Does this make sense? And then that means that for any new image that you care to make a prediction for, you can run it through this and get a prediction for what the fMRI activation for that new image ought to be like. And then you can take that image and just use nearest neighbor, so the humble classifier we saw at the beginning, to compare it to images in the training set. And this achieves incredible accuracy, close to 90%, on hundreds of images. So it's really fantastic. And so it's kind of a testament to saying you have some model that you want to test, in this case this Gabor filter pyramid, and you think that it's the right model. You can input it at the heart of the whole procedure, and you get tremendous power at making predictions based on it. So it's not quite saying that that's exactly what the brain is doing, but given all the other things that you know, it's a way of testing that this knowledge about the computation being done in visual cortex is reasonable or not. And so that's kind of my main message, is that so what we're going to get out of training classifiers on fMRI data depends on what you're willing to believe in about what's happening in the brain. So in the first case, in the second case study with the visual cortex, there was no, you couldn't really see any relationships between voxels. As far as you know, no voxel had preference for any orientation. So the most you can do is kind of pull information across them, at least at that high resolution, at that lower resolution. At the other end is this bizarre world where what a voxel does means nothing unless you consider what all the other voxels do. And you have this complicated combinatorial code between voxels where, and in this horrible world, there's very little we might be able to say unless we have an infinite amount of training data. Thankfully, the truth lies somewhere in the middle. So maybe we can expect voxels to encode things that make sense, like that visual computation, or maybe we're talking about semantic categories, maybe a few voxels code for inanimate versus animate, and for other breakdowns that we know are present from other sources of evidence. So as long as you can say something about the coding that ought to be there, probably the truth is somewhere in the middle. And the question is, how do you take that knowledge and incorporate it into classifiers in order to test things? So this is pretty much what I've just been saying, packed more neatly. So I just wanted to leave you with these three questions. So essentially, you have to think of which of these three you want to answer. Hopefully I've convinced you that classifiers can be used to do all three. And I will just do a quick shameless plug, which is the Princeton MVPA toolbox has a lot of code and, especially important, tutorials on how to train classifiers on fMRI data and also sample data sets. So it's a good way to get your feet wet on this. I encourage you to check it out. And my final message is, now that you know a lot more about classifiers' work, you will not be tempted, I hope, to go write a paper that says, we can do mind reading, we can predict this or that with this accuracy, because now you know that it's actually an estimate and it has at least a confidence interval. Thank you very much for your attention, and I'll take any questions now.
So
the tutorial gets... Sorry?
Could you repeat the question, please?
Yeah, so what Stephen is saying is that if you use feature selection within the training set, as I suggested, and you try many different numbers of features, I hope this is the case you're referring to. You try many different numbers of features, and for every number you try, you get a different accuracy. And you then go and pick the one that looks the juiciest and report just that. This is grossly optimistic. It's really, really bad. And so it's in part what I was alluding to through multiple comparisons, but the tutorial, and you can email me for that, goes into that at a certain length. But it's a very important point, is that typically people try many things and they'll report just one, and you should at least kind of give the reviewers a table of all the things that you've tried, what accuracies you got, and then the reviewer can, and how many test examples you had, and then the reviewer can kind of decide whether to trust it or ask you to do further tests. Thank you, Stephen. That's a very important point.
Another question?
Along that same line, though, is there a problem with doing, say, like a two-step cross-validation? So cross-validation within your training set.
Not at all.
To do your parameter selection or your feature selection, and then choose your parameters that way, and then do the...
So what he's suggesting is saying, instead of, say, doing feature selection and trying on your training set and trying many different numbers of features and training a classifier for each different number, you could do a further cross-validation inside your training set to decide on how many features to use. That's actually what I recommend people do if they know what they're doing, because it saves you the hassle and it kind of gives you a much less biased estimate of what true accuracy can be. it kind of compounds the problem in that you're always picking a different number of features, so it makes it slightly harder to interpret, but on the other hand, it's a very nice way of getting around the problem that Stephen was pointing out. So yeah, you're absolutely correct.
Does it run into problems? Are there issues that you're aware of?
No. It's perfectly fine. So the only problem is that the more of these nested things you do, the less data you have. But as long as you have some parameter that you want to, for instance, if you have a regularization parameter in your classifier, doing the nested cross-validation tests in the training set to set your parameters is the thing to do. So no problem at all. In fact, that's actually recommended.
I had two questions. One was, you gave one or two examples of the kind of results people get. What's the state of the art of being able to reconstruct, to recognize from fMRI data things like what word is being shown? And the second question is, if people were curious to try other machine learning techniques, are there publicly available?
Okay, so the speaker, you had two questions. The first one was, what's the state of the art and what can be done? I normally have a slide on that when the talk is for computer scientists, and I did have a slide on that for this talk, because in part I'm kind of a bit wary of the whole, here's how high an accuracy we got at this or that, but I think the state of the art is the one that I showed you.
65.
No. So at doing things like distinguishing different words, different categories, you could do 8 categories with 80 to 90% accuracy. The one that I showed you had hundreds of different images, so the by chance would be really low value, and they could get close to 90%. So it can get fairly high, but I hope the point that was clear here was that the accuracy is not the whole part of the story. So the interpretability also matters, and if what you want to do is find out what's going on, then you want some accuracy, but it's not the whole thing. But so the rough answer is, it's possible to get pretty high with large numbers of classes, given the amount of data that people typically have. But I can tell you more details about the caveats in the different things. Maybe this is too much to get into. Your second question was,
Are there any databases publicly available of fMRI data if people wanted to?
So whether there's publicly available data. The Princeton MVPA toolbox has code, tutorials, and a sample data set. So it's one thing that you could start with. The fMRIDC, I'm not sure if the fMRIDC is still taking requests for data, probably not. The other place I would look is, you can ask me afterwards, the machine learning courses at CMU have sample fMRI data sets in convenient formats. So I can give you a pointer to that.
FBurn also has data sets available on the
web. So FBurn?
Yeah.
Okay, Stevens is saying FBurn also has sample data sets, so if people need...
There's one more. Walt Schneider was supposed to give a talk at the Pittsburgh decoding competition.
As Nico is saying, the Pittsburgh brain analysis, brain image analysis competition had two public data sets, although it's data sets where the predictions are mostly about continuous variables, so a bit different from this flavor. But on the other hand, they're much more interesting and rich, so they're worth checking. It's the PBAIC is the thing you should Google for.
In terms of separation, the decision service. And in a sense also, it's the one that converts the slowest. So it needs the more example to get a certain result. It's a very complicated classifier.
Well, Lars is absolutely correct. So I told you that there were growth simplifications here, and this is one of them. So the nearest neighbor only appears to be simple, but in fact, it actually can produce strikingly complex decisions depending on what you use as the distance metric. And the other thing that's kind of interesting that I probably should have mentioned is that if you're using a nearest neighbor, you can also decompose the contribution of every voxel to the decision depending if you use one of, say, Euclidean distance or correlation similarity or cosine similarity. And so you can still do that, this kind of attribution of responsibility of every voxel in making that classification. That's something that we have in one of the appendices of our tutorial. But Lars is correct. It's a surprisingly complex classifier under the hood. And so, and this is why I wanted to put it up, because often it's something that's neglected. It's very easy to try and very intuitive to explain to people. I know people that, still don't use any other classifiers. They just use nearest neighbor because they understand the notion that in order to classify, images have to be similar in some space. And then they are very peculiar about what space they consider. And that's where most of the subtlety comes in, rather than in the machinery. But thank you for bringing that up.
So you mentioned the idea of trying to incorporate neuroscience priors into the selection of classifiers or projections onto your feature space. But it was very curious in the example images you showed us that white matter seemed to be incorporated willy-nilly. And you know, what has been done in terms of exploration of surface extraction, for example, trying to incorporate features such as spatial topology on flattened sheets as neural priors. There's a lot of information there that seems not to be used.
Yeah, if you gave me data that had been flattened, I would take it in a heartbeat. Because at that point, you kind of say, my feature space is not just vector. So this simply, casting the feature space as a huge high-dimensional vector is a traditional machine learning thing to do, but it's astoundingly stupid for fMRI data. Because we know that even if you just consider the grid, neighboring voxels might be doing very similar things or related things. And as Mark was saying, if you actually consider the cortical sheet and you flattened it, then you're looking at voxels that lie on a graph of things that are connected. And once you are in that space, you can start saying, I want neighboring voxels to not necessarily be weighted similarly, but to have similar importances. Maybe one is up and one is down, but the weights should be of comparable magnitudes. You can exclude lots of stuff out. So in some sense, this is kind of the bottom line. It's saying, if you just treat the whole thing as a vector and you don't have a nice enough mask to work from, this is what you get. But what you're saying makes perfect sense.
We should take a 5-minute break, I think, because we're running late. See you in 5 minutes.